Okay, welcome everybody. My name is Janet Warren. I'm going to be chairing the Mind Sciences session. This is the first session we have. We have a lot of exciting talks and just not enough time. We're going to start with Dr. Nahani Freeman, and she's going to be presenting on non-determinism and plasticity, the role of bidirectional brain behavior relationships in sanctification.
Oh, and where do I advance this? Just on the keyboard?
Yeah, you can move it to the keyboard over there.
So I'd like to begin by identifying four primary assumptions, which are commonly held by clinical psychologists, and I think lay kind of a groundwork for what I'm going to be discussing today. The first is the assumption of multiple causation. So in clinical psychology, we have the idea that there are not essentialist explanations for human behavior or reactions, but rather multiple levels of causation, including cultural, social, language, classical and operant conditioning, cognitive, behavioral, neurochemical, structural abnormalities in the brain, psychopathology, developmental needs and drives theories, and identity-based quests. The second assumption that I think is important for my talk today is the importance of gene-environment interactionism, including evocative, passive, and reactive effects between the human being and their environment and their genetic endowment. The third assumption that I think will be important is the diathesis stress model, which is a way that we understand psychopathology and clinical psychology, that there are genetic propensities that interact with environmental triggers to create a probability that a mental disorder may exist. These are models of etiology. And lastly, my fourth assumption is going to be malleability, that change is an important assumption and interacts with resilience models. We're going to be looking at some of these. And we assume that psychosocial interventions impact neurochemistry. There are common philosophical positions held by psychologists on the mind-body question, although certainly there are many who hold to a material monist position. However, there are other psychologists who hold the view of indeterminism, that while human behavior may be caused from a host of unknown events, these causes cannot be fully measured. And people change when they're observed. We know this from the Hawthorne studies, industrial organizational psychology, which were influenced by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and applied to psychological constructs. A second possible philosophical assumption on the mind-body question for psychologists is non-determinism. And philosophers define these in various ways, but I'll be talking about this as the idea that human behavior is uncaused, or that we perceive our own behaviors often as chosen, despite the existence of compelling, influential forces. A third possible avenue is soft determinism, often held by clinical psychologists, implying that biological and environmental events create probabilities, but don't entirely determine behaviors. So I'd like to introduce my first thesis point for today, which is that health-conducive, relationally attuned forms of religiosity, sanctification, and spirituality may enhance the brain's utilization of reward pathways, including mesolimbic pathways and dopaminergic neurons, may decrease reactivity in the brain's stress system, including the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, may trigger adaptive placebo effects and promote epigenetic changes such as methylation and chromatin remodeling that foster neuroplasticity and neural integration, which is positive adaptive neuroplastic changes, fostering greater resilience for mental health and physical health. I think this also intersects with the idea of neurotheology, which has been put forth by Diakoli and Newborg, which implies that the quest for spiritual and transcendent experiences is hardwired, which could partly explain the relationship between health and spirituality, which is often but not universally observed. Definitions of both spirituality and sanctification vary greatly, and we could spend a lot of time on this. In Protestant theology, sanctification is often described as the pursuit of holiness or being set apart for a holy purpose, and this form of maturation often intersects with psychological variables, development, altruism, even self-actualization as described by Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers. Psychological integrative models of sanctification often consider things like self-concept formation, attachment, self-other differentiation, psychopathology, and integrate these, as you see in the works of Naremore, Oden, Meisner, John Coe, Hokema, and others. In addition, we could even consider the notion of theosis in Orthodox Christianity, where sanctification involves union with God and transformation. So a couple of organizing questions I asked myself in creating this talk included, how do repetitive thoughts and actions, spiritual and relational, impact the ongoing dynamic processes of change in the brain? And how does the ongoing process of spiritual maturation impact the brain? Can we measure this? Hollingsworth suggests that claims that dynamic, neuronal, and synaptic changes in the brain are embedded within a relational system, and that we create new neural connections with the experience of meaningful relationships. For today's topic, the relationship with the divine, the self, and others, both within and without the religious community, have the potential to impact neuroplasticity and may be moderated by mirror neurons in the frontal and parietal cortex, which have been shown by Cozzolino and others to be connected to relational attunement, empathy, and compassion. There's evidence that many spiritual practices result in changes in the brain, including contemplation, meditation, and mindfulness. Newborg created an interesting study to examine Carmelite nuns who had engaged in 15 or more years of contemplative prayer using the centering prayer, and he found that they had lower levels of amygdala activation. The amygdala is often active when we encounter threats, when we experience fear or anger, and also has been shown to be more active when we encounter faces from other races. What is the relationship between sanctification and the developmental psychological concept of resilience, which is often defined as successful adaptation and swift recovery after adversity, including post-traumatic growth? This is when, following an experience of suffering, an individual actually returns to a level of functioning that exceeds their baseline level, and through this experience of suffering, they actually have a strengthening experience on a psychological level. Okay. So just
down arrow.
Press the down arrow. Oh, down arrow.
The right one works as well.
Okay, great. All right, so I'm going to assume that many of you are familiar with neuroplasticity, and just identify a few different forms that neuroplasticity may take. We include the consideration of experience-dependent plasticity, which would be your experiences interact with the plasticity in the brain. So we have changes including the formation of new neurons, the pruning of unused neural connections, the increased myelination of axons, which conducts a neural impulse more rapidly, and alteration to the number of dendritic spines. Also, interestingly, changes in levels of intracellular signaling molecules, which are inside of the cell and elicit changes in another cell, and then epigenetic changes that I mentioned earlier. These are just a few examples of a gene-environment interaction. This has been shown, the impact of stress upon the hippocampus. There are a variety of studies in primates and humans to show these effects. And here are some of the alterations that can occur with cumulative stress appearing to be the most harmful to the hippocampus, which can impact memory, particularly in individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the important features of epigenetic changes in the brain is that through methylation and chromatin changes, they can affect gene silencing or expression of genes. Okay. So I have included a definition of epigenetics. This comes from Rutan et al. 2013. And you can see that with epigenetic changes, there are things that affect genetic transcription, the expression of genes, and these can occur in various stages of development. Epigenetic alterations play a critical role in age-related neurological changes in memory, learning, motivation, and reward. Interesting study was conducted post-mortem on the brains of suicide victims. And they compared two groups. One group of suicide victims reported or had a history in their medical records of childhood abuse, and one did not. Those who had abuse showed altered methylation in the hippocampus, and specifically in a region called NR3C1, which protects against stress, decreases stress hormone, and part of it is activated by an epigenetic switch. This resulted in a decrease in genetic expression of NR3C1 in the hippocampus. And so a quote that I appreciate from Rutan on gene-environment interactions is, experience-dependent regulation of gene expression by the epigenetic machinery impacting on genes involved in the HPA axis and the mesolimbic dopaminergic reward system underlies the psychological building blocks of resilience by mediating the response and enduring the impact of stressors throughout life. One of the ways that religiosity may alter the brain potentially could be through relationships and attachments. There is quite a bit of evidence that attachment can impact and lead to epigenetic changes in the brain. For instance, early maltreatment can result in disruption of the development of the corpus callosum, which allows the left and right hemisphere to communicate, and can also affect the structures in the brain that control emotional regulation, such as the prefrontal cortex. Relational connections also promote the facilitation of oxytocin, a neuropeptide with stress and anxiety buffering effects, which acts together with neurotransmitters in reward areas of the brain and may affect one's ability and readiness to perceive rewards. There's some very interesting rat studies on the effects of maternal deprivation on various structures in the brain and neurochemistry. In one study, they found that rats who had very nurturing mothers had higher glucocorticoid or stress receptors in the hippocampus into adulthood and permanent changes in the hypothalamus and hippocampus. You could also see here that neurotrophins and nerve growth factor and brain-derived neurotrophic factor have all been shown in rat studies to be influenced by maternal separation. I wanted to just mention something about brain-derived neurotrophic factor here because it is important to, it's a protein encoded in the BDNF gene, which promotes the survival of nerve cells, growth, differentiation, and maintenance of neurons. So how might religion change the brain? One of the ways that has been very well researched is through meditation. Some of these are outside of what we would maybe consider traditional Christian practice, although if you look in Christian history, there's a long tradition of meditation and contemplative practices going back to the Desert Fathers and the Carmelite mystics. But certainly there is evidence that increased gray matter has been observed following meditative practices. And there's also evidence that meditation and mindfulness and loving kindness meditation can have an impact on the immune system as well. After 8 weeks of mindfulness training in a study reported in Davidson 2008, subjects demonstrated increased antibody production in response to a flu vaccine. Loving-kindness meditation has also been shown to moderate the responses in the insula often associated with the perception of disgust, cingulate cortices, amygdala, and areas linked to empathy and theory of mind or perspective taking, the ability to understand another person's mind. In an interesting study by Newberg, Wintering, Klasse et al. In 2010, they found that with patients who had mild to moderate memory loss and they engaged in meditation, their memory was improved by 10 to 15%. And they think that part of this may be due to increased frontal lobe activation, frontal lobes causing you to really attend to something carefully and to utilize your cognitive resources more effectively. Perhaps one of the mechanisms by which religion seems to be associated with health is the increased sense of meaning in life and the sense of coherence that is established. Newberg talks about this as he argues that the drive for religion is not going to go away because we are created with causal operators and holistic operators. The causal operators are attempts to understand causes for events and contingencies, and the holistic operators are attempts to create holistic understandings in our perceptual organization and also to seek out harmony, symmetry, and other aesthetically pleasing things. An interesting study has demonstrated that prayer or a sense of union with God may activate the left dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, caudate, and orbital frontal cortex, which are involved in positive feelings in the brain's reward system. So I think it could be argued that one of the mechanisms that could establish this link between health, mental and psychological and physical health, and spirituality could be the activation of the reward system and also the suppression of the stress system, including the suppression of responses in the HPA axis. In an interesting study that also shows the brain-environment link, mice were exposed to a social defeat paradigm. And this is where they took mice who were kind of small, kind of submissive mice, and they placed them into cages with mice who were much larger and more aggressive. Pretty stressful event. And they found that changes occurred in their brains in addition to their behaviors. So they showed more subordination. They also showed increased corticosterone, molecular and cellular changes, decreased orexin. This is a hormone produced in the hypothalamus that has the role of sleep and appetite. And there was less orexin signaling in the hypothalamus. But what was really interesting to me about this study was that not all of the mice showed these changes in response to social defeat stress. There were only certain mice who seemed to have these vulnerabilities, which fits with the diathesis stress model. And also may underlie some of the changes that are observed, for instance, in cardiac patients. I examined a number of interesting studies on cardiac risk factors and biomarkers and how these interact with stress, including things like C-reactive protein and levels of interleukin-6, which is a risk factor shown to be connected to inflammation responses and immune reactions. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to move ahead to the placebo information, and then I'll conclude with some philosophical assumptions. So there are many studies that show that religion may positively impact health. There have been studies demonstrating lower rates of heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, metabolic disturbance, and also better immune functioning, improved outcomes with HIV and meningitis, lower cancer risk, faster surgery recovery, and less medical service utilization. In fact, there is at least one study showing that religious attendance has been linked to 7 to 14 years longer lifespan. In a meta-analysis of 91 studies, meta-analysis, many of you probably know, but it's when you combine a lot of studies and then statistically analyze them, they found that the impact of religiosity and health seems to persist even when health promotion factors are accounted for, things like not smoking, not drinking excessively, exercising, following medical regimes, and so forth. So the studies demonstrate that not only are the effects, the beneficial effects of spirituality not only caused from health promotion, but they're not only caused from social support either. Jo Marchant has a very interesting book on placebo effects called Cure, and in it she reviews a variety of interesting research studies. And what she's arguing is that these placebo effects are triggering the body's natural immune system in response to expectancies. And one of the interesting things in her work is that she reviews research showing that you can actually classically condition placebo-related associations in animals and in humans. And placebos can even work if the patient knows that they're receiving a placebo. So the deception is not the primary reason why placebos work. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and conclude. Let's see. Okay. So I'll give a couple basic conclusions and then talk about some philosophical assumptions. An array of mechanisms, I've listed many of them here, moderate the relationship between health-conducive spirituality, sanctification, and neuroplasticity. There's an excellent review of the positive and negative findings between health, mental and physical, and spirituality in the Psychology of Religion textbook by Hood, Hill, and Spilka. It shows really the range of mixed findings on this topic. And I'm going to argue that ultimately the relationship between neuroplasticity and spirituality is rooted in the brain's innate capacities for rhythmicity, like we're looking for and detecting signs in the environment that we're not about to face a threat, which may be why meditation has its positive effects. Spirituality may activate parasympathetic arousal to reduce anxiety, may assist us with unity, coherence, and may be something that facilitates attunement, emotional attunement with others. So gene-environment interactionism and malleability, I will argue, weaken determinist and essentialist explanations of human perception, human reactions, and human behaviors. Going back to the physiologist Johannes Mueller and his law of specific nerve energies, he argued that the mind does not access actual objects in the environment, only nervous system sensations. In contrast to this, we see neural identity theory, which I will define as the idea that mental events equate fully and simply to neurological representation. The law of specific nerve energies fits better with teleological behaviorism, or the idea that the mind is the correlation over time between the environment and behavior, the borderline between the body and the world. There are some weaknesses in neural identity theory, one of them being that the mind organizes information esoterically, and that there are no single neural pathways that correspond to each mental property or subjectively experienced perception. So perhaps an alternative might be emergentism. A property of a system is more than the sum of that system's parts, which actually is a fundamental thesis of Gestalt psychology. Emergent states of consciousness depend on physical and chemical properties, yet cannot be fully predicted by or reduced to physical and chemical forces. They have some independent elements. Hilary Putnam has put forth some interesting arguments against modern physicalism, the idea that the mind is identical to physical states. She argues it is unlikely that brain states are identical to subjective states, because each organism has unique experience in brain states. And she offers rather the idea of multiple realizability, that the same mental properties can be elicited by different physical states and processes. I'll conclude just by saying, kind of in summary to the conclusions, after studying psychology for 17 years, I've drawn the conclusion that it's very difficult to sustain the idea of determinism or essentialism in understanding human perception, behavior, and emotion. Thank you.
Time for a couple of questions, and maybe we could do a little bit of musical chairs. People want to maybe trade who've been sitting with those who've been standing or sitting on the floor. There's one extra chair. And if you guys want to come up and
get...
No, sorry, you're not next. And Miretu Gutta, you're next if you want to come to the front and... Okay, question.
Yes.
Given you talk about the religiosity and the biological effects,
I mean, how can you exclude the possibility that religion is simply an adaptive feature of human behavior that improves our survival? There really isn't anything real to it. I mean, spiritual to it.
Right. Yeah, actually, this is something that Newberg addresses that I think he has an interesting point. He argues that on the basis of the correspondence between health and spirituality, or some forms of spirituality, because there are health-destructive forms as well, he states you can't establish anything about the ontological reality of God through that. You can't. It doesn't say whether God exists or not. It says that spirituality is something that seems to, in positive expressions, benefit human beings. And there may be arguments that could be made, apologetic arguments, but I guess I haven't encountered those yet. So, yes.
Oh, in regards to the religiosity, was it religion as well, or was it specifically Christianity?
Right, that's a great question. So Newberg argues that neurotheology should study all religions and different expressions, and so many of the studies on meditation have looked at Buddhist meditation, and there are some interesting articles on Buddhism and neuroscience. But he also has spent a fair amount of time looking at Catholic contemplative practices in nuns and other monastic kind of traditions, and so at least for looking at SPECT and PET scan activation areas in response to different kinds of states, including what he identifies as absolute unitary being, which I thought was kind of similar to the idea of Unio Christo that we have with the ecstasy of St. Teresa and sometimes reported earlier in Christian history. Yes?
Since fasting is common in a lot of religions, including
Christianity,
has anyone looked at fasting and meditation? How does it impact?
Interesting. For this talk, I didn't look at a lot of articles on that, but I have seen, as I was looking for social psych things for a class that I teach, evidence that different kinds of deprivation, like fasting, can make a person more susceptible to certain kinds of social paradigms and heuristics or cognitive shortcuts, and also can cause rewarding experiences to be more rewarding, increasing more activation in the mesolimbic reward system. So, any other questions?
You have about one more minute if you wanted to fill us in on anything else that you missed.
Or Well, I mean, I guess I would just say that there are a lot of different models of how to think about what sanctification is. There are some really interesting writings in the Journal of Psychology and Theology, and also in a book called Psychology and Christianity Integration, that present just a range of viewpoints on how human development, models of health versus pathology, intersect with theological views of spiritual maturation. And John Coe has some interesting work on this as well, arguing that there's often an intersection between a person's psychological health and their spiritual health, although it is possible to be in one of a different quadrant with relationship to how those two coexist.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.